Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's focus is racism and labor. We regularly spend time taking a look at the impact of racism in a range of areas in our world. It is a year-long project. I am delighted to welcome you to today's conversation and delighted as well to welcome Bill Fletcher Jr. Bill Fletcher is a prolific writer. He is the co-author of several books, including with Peter Agard, The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of Congress. Of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, 1934 to 1941. Bill, welcome to Mind Talk. That title is more than a notion.
I'm just pleased, always. You know, this is an honor and a pleasure.
Well, you know, I make specific reference to the book that focuses on 1934 to 41. Still mindful of the fact that clearly you are an activist, you are a radio talk show host, a co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal. I mean, there are just so many important things that you've done. But the reason that I specify this particular book, which is not the only one you've written, is because I'd really like to go back to the beginnings, if you will, of the formation of a labor union. So talk to us briefly, if you would, about the National Labor Union of 1866.
Yeah. I have to say that I think you're the first person who is ever asking that question in a non-academic setting. And I'm delighted. So what happened is the trade union movement, as we know it, that is the development of things that look like labor unions, really starts in the 1830s, 1840s, during this strange period that's called the Jacksonian Democracy, after Andrew Jackson, the president then. It's a real misnomer, that's another discussion. And essentially, these organizations, many of them being looking like guilds, were started in different cities. Sometimes they were organized around a particular factory. Sometimes they were citywide. There were other formations that took place. There were labor parties that were actually formed. But prior to the Civil War, one of the biggest questions that split the movement was the question of slavery. And the existence of slavery, and whether those workers, at that point white workers, men and women, should take a stand against slavery, or should they actually support slavery. And so the movement was very divided, and then on top of that, there was an immense amount of repression by employers and by government. And by repression, I don't mean harsh language. I mean people being killed. Now, after the Civil War, there were two distinct things that happened. One that has received a fair amount of attention in history, which you just mentioned, the National Labor Union. The second, actually there were three things. The second and third received very little attention in history. One was something called the Colored National Labor Union, and the other was a strike wave that took place in the South that involved black workers. So the National Labor Union was the first attempt to actually build a national labor federation in the United States. And it was largely in the Northeast and Midwest, but particularly the Northeast, and it was led by a man named William Silvis. And the idea was to try to build a federation or confederation of different labor unions that had come together. The problem that they ran across was in some ways, in many ways, very much related to the problem that had divided the movement before the Civil War. That is the question of the black worker and whether the black worker, but also Asian workers, should be permitted into labor unions. The National Labor Union took the position that they would not be allowed in. And it was sort of a precursor to almost a separate but equal. And at the same time, and quite ironically, the National Labor Union was calling upon black people, generally black workers in particular, to abandon any work with the Republican Party. And at that point, the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln, the party of abolition, and the party of Reconstruction, this dramatic effort to transform the South and introduce something that came close to democracy. So you have this irony where black workers are basically being told, no, we're not going to let you into our movement, but let's unite and form something else, a labor party or something else. And black folks basically just didn't go for it. It didn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the Republican Party has changed. That's an understatement, isn't it, since those
dramatically,
days?
Dramatically. But it's interesting. It was a slow boil change.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1860s, there was and it's not overstating it, there was a radical wing, and I mean radical in the best sense of the word, wing of the Republican Party that really was about transforming the South. And this wing of the Republican Party worked in concert with black former slaves and former slave population and the former and those that had never been in slavery. It worked together to build up a very different kind of South. You had the introduction of public schools. You had, I mentioned before that there was this strike wave between 1866 and 1868 in the South by black workers, where they were actually quite successful in winning wages, higher wages, and starting to change their conditions. And so this was going on up until the mid-1870s, and it was being targeted by white terrorist groups that were supported by the wealthy white plantocracy, former plantocracy. And then ultimately, the leadership of the Republican Party, having gained the subordination of the former ruling class in the South, and having gained their acceptance that the United States would stay together and that it would go in a certain direction, they lost interest in the South. And so you saw then the Republican Party becoming increasingly a party of the rich, but it was a slow boil, and African Americans remained fairly loyal to the Republican Party until a real crack happened in the 1930s.
And what happened in the 1930s to cause that shift?
Well, the first thing was the major trigger was the Depression.
Okay.
And so the Depression really kicks off in 1929, 1930, and the United States was then led by President Hoover, who was advocating economic policies that are in many ways very similar to policies currently advocated by the Republicans. Lack of government intervention and addressing the depth of the crisis. I mean, the Depression, we were talking about 1 out of 4 people were out of work. Think about that. I mean, 25% of the workforce was out of work and was destitute. And you did not have Social Security. You did not have unemployment insurance. And so in steps the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, whose campaign, contrary to myth, was fairly lackluster in 1932. You didn't really have that much of a sense that he was going to introduce dramatic changes, but when he succeeded, he won in part because people were completely disgusted with Hoover's idiotic approach to the economy. So he comes in and is confronted with the depth of the crisis, and that the United States was just in essence coming apart. And so it begins to institute certain reforms that have come to be known as the New Deal.
Okay.
And Social Security. Mm-hmm. We have unemployment. There were the creation of jobs programs. A number of things. And many of these programs had an impact on black folks. But I say many, because what happened is that in order to pass much of the legislation that Roosevelt was aiming to move, he had to deal with what was called at the time the Solid South. The South was dominated by a very different Democratic Party than the party we're looking at today. It was the party of white supremacy. And so you had a very significant split within the Democratic Party. In the North and the Midwest and the West Coast, you had a Democratic Party that was beginning to transform and beginning to reach other constituencies, particularly organized labor, which had a relationship with the Democratic Party, but now was desperately in need of assistance in the depth of the Depression. But in the South, you had the same old white supremacists who were dominating the South. So Roosevelt had to felt he needed to strike a deal with them in order to pass some of this legislation. Contained in various components of the legislation were provisions that made it possible to continue segregation.
I see.
In the way that services were delivered, or the segments of the population that were affected. And one example that I think is useful is the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in 1935. Very, very significant change, legalized the right to collective bargaining and unionization, the self-organization of workers. There were two significant segments of the population that were excluded: domestic workers and agricultural workers. And why was that? Well, because in the South and the Southwest, the ruling groupings there feared that permitting domestic workers and agricultural workers to organize would change the balance of power. And would change the balance of power because those were two significant, those were two segments of the population, domestic, largely African American. Agricultural, in the Southwest, Latino and Asian. And the dominant forces there did not want those segments of the population to have anything close to organization. So Roosevelt had to make certain, he felt he had to make certain compromises. Whether he had to or not is a different story.
Right.
In that context, black folks started to think or started to conclude that the Republican Party did not offer much in the way of a future. But the ultimate change takes place in the 1960s.
In the 1960s. Before we go there, let's go back a little bit. Tell me about the formation of the Knights of Labor and how was that different from the National Labor Union?
The Knights of Labor was actually a fascinating formation. It was much like a federation. But it was not restricted to labor unions. And that's one thing that made it very different than the forms of organization that came after it, like the American Federation of Labor or the Congress of Industrial Organizations or today's AFL-CIO. The Knights of Labor had unions. It had worker cooperatives. It had social clubs. It was almost the equivalent of a counter society, and I don't mean that in some sort of whether conspiratorial or dark terms, but it was an alternative approach to organizing working people, and basically saying that to be a working person was not just a matter of what happened in the workplace, but it was about the kind of society that was going to be built.
What was the role of African Americans and of women within the Knights of Labor? Were they welcomed or not?
Well, interesting. Both were welcomed, although the African American role in the Knights of Labor was quite important in terms of the evolution of that formation, but also its impact in organizing black folks when Reconstruction was falling apart. In other words, what happens is the Knights of Labor emerges around the same time that the Reconstruction is being destroyed. And when I talk about being destroyed, I don't mean it just simply collapsed on its own, that these terrorist groups like the KKK, the Knights of the White Camellia, and others were actively involved in insurrectionary activities. There was massive intimidation of voters. There was, in the period roughly between 1870 and early 1900s, there were governments that were overthrown. The most well-known probably was in North Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina. So so you have that going on. Black folks were trying to figure out how to best organize themselves, and many became attracted to the Knights of Labor that created an organizational vehicle within which they could operate and they could fight. There's a guy named Peter Rakshlev who wrote a very interesting book some years ago, 20 years ago, about the black workers and the Knights of Labor in the state of Virginia. So it was critically important. Now, with women in the labor movement, here's one, and it goes beyond the issue of the Knights of Labor. What's interesting is that up until fairly recently, if you'd read most histories of organized labor, you'd get the sense that the unions were formed by men, that in the early 1900s, women got involved in the textile and garment industry for a while, then sort of vanished, and then all of a sudden in the 1960s, 1970s, they reemerge. And that's only a slight exaggeration in terms of the way that much mainstream history presented it. What actually happened is that when unions started in the 1830s, they were from the very beginning, it was both women and men that were organizing. Now, they generally organized in segregated organizations or unions. That is, both because of the way that work was done, which was highly segregated on gender lines, but also because of the dominant thinking of the time and the virulent male supremacy. You had women's groups and you had men's groups. But the fact of the matter is that from the beginning, you had men and women engaged in building unions, and sometimes they were in the same unions. And this continues on to this day. In the early 1900s, you had, of course, what was called the Rising of the Women, which was this insurgency of sorts, worker insurgency in New York, around the time of the infamous Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, in which workers were incinerated because of the failure of the company to allow them out of a burning building, in effect. And so you had this period of a mass insurgency of women workers that began to build new unions. Unfortunately, in many cases, if not most, for years those unions nevertheless were dominated by men, even if the majority of the members were women.
Interesting. Bill, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Thank you. as you're sharing with us the history of the unions and the ways in which women and African Americans were incorporated or not, I find myself thinking how far we've come and yet how little we've moved. Tell us about the AFL. When was the AFL, when did they come into being? And talk to us about their formal policy that they represented everyone, but in actuality, not so much.
Yes, the story of the AFL is in many ways, I find, a very sad one. It was formed at the time that the Knights of Labor was starting to decline. The Knights of Labor, interestingly enough, did not see itself in any way as confrontational with business. But that became hard to sustain when they were constantly attacked when they tried to organize. And by attacked, I really mean attacked. There were violent attacks on the Knights of Labor around the country by government forces and by employers. The American Federation of Labor began with a different theory. Its principal leader was a man named Samuel Gompers, who had probably the most important ideological impact on organized labor in the United States of any labor leader. And a lot of that impact, I would argue, was terrible. But in either case, he remained a very central figure. The American Federation of Labor identified itself as a network or federation of labor unions. They were going to restrict themselves to what has been called at different points bread and butter trade unionism or pure and simple trade unionism. That is, fighting around wages, hours, working conditions, and that's it. So there was not going to be the broader social vision that had existed in a number of the prior formations, including the Knights of Labor, or labor parties that were emerging first in the United States and then in other parts of the world. They were going to keep it simple. The affiliates to the American Federation of Labor were to be granted a tremendous amount of autonomy. So each of the unions that created the AFL was basically told, in so many words, that there was very little that they had to fear from this federation. A federation would not interfere with the internal affairs of those individual unions. So they began. Now, the other thing that they did is that they emphasized what's called craft unionism, which was referring to organizing workers largely by skill. So most of the unions that became part of the AFL, with the notable exception of the United Mine Workers of America and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, were craft unions, you know, for example, the sure. electrician, mm-hmm. the carpenters, plumbers, et cetera.
And so they effectively, it sounds like, were able to eliminate African Americans because African Americans weren't given an entrance into those trades. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
This is where the story gets particularly sad, but is of great importance. After the Civil War, contrary to, you know, films like Birth of a Nation or even Gone with the Wind, black workers were, in many cases in the South, in key strategic, craft-skilled positions. They were the ones that were running the railroads. I don't mean own the railroads. I mean the firemen, the oilers, the engineers. They were construction workers. They were they were carpenters, etc.
Those sound like skilled trades.
That's exactly what it was.
Okay.
That's exactly what it was. And you think about it from the standpoint of the slave owner. The slave owner was not hiring someone. They had property, the slave, they were investing in. So the slave played these roles. If you were bringing up someone from the very beginning and the idea is you want to invest in them to become a carpenter, you know, you're looking at it as a long-term investment, not in a human being, but in a piece of property, which right. is the way we were treated. Okay, so after the Civil War, when you have the abolition of slavery, there's this flip. So you have these skilled black workers, and between 1866 and 1905, there was a massive racial cleansing that takes place in this country, particularly in the South, in the skilled trades and in the railroads. So there was a white supremacist collaboration that takes place at that time, and it's very, very evident in the railroads, where there are what were called railroad brotherhoods. These were unions of railroad workers. They were set up by whites. They had white-only clauses, and in many cases it was white male-only clauses. But there were black workers working at the same time. And so when those black workers would quit, die off, or be killed, they would not be replaced by other blacks, they would be replaced by whites. So you saw the systemic change that unfolds over a 40-year period. Now, why that's important for us to always keep in mind is that when arguments around affirmative action have been raised, you frequently get that counter where people, you know, white people will say, or even some very confused black people, they'll say, well, you know, you shouldn't give something to someone who didn't deserve it. You know, why should you give something to someone who didn't work for it? Something along those lines. But here's the problem. And this is why history becomes very important. If you look at history, you understand we actually had the positions.
Right.
We were the skilled workers in the South. We were running the railroads. We were driven out. So how do you repair the damage? And that's when the opponents of affirmative action become silent. They have no answer. And so you had this cleansing of these industries of black workers. So when the AFL emerges, it permits into its ranks unions that had white male-only clauses. And the argument that Samuel Gompers makes, but he doesn't make it at first. He evolves into becoming an outright white supremacist. But he begins by saying, almost in formal legal terms, we can't interfere with the internal affairs of the different affiliates. So if an affiliate wants to let black workers in, that's up to them. If it wants to let, if it doesn't, then it's fine, it's up to them. Now, in the early 1900s, the AFL has become the main federation of unions. And on the West Coast, there was this union that got formed called the Japanese-Mexican Labor Union. And it obviously represented Japanese and Mexicans. So they approached the AFL to affiliate. Samuel Gompers sends them a letter. He actually sends the letter to the Mexicans. And he says, get rid of the Japanese and we'll let you in. Now, the union wrote a response. And the response is one of those responses that I wish that today's AFL CIO would embolden on its walls. And it basically tells Samuel Gompers, in so many words, where to go, how to get there, and what rate of speed.
Okay.
And it's a remarkable statement because they basically say, we are a union. We are a union of Japanese and Mexicans, and we're not sacrificing one part of our membership in the interest of another. And so you can take this and do whatever you want.
So many lessons to be learned.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So many lessons to be learned from history.
Absolutely. You see, I was in an event the other day, and I said to people, What you have to understand about the United States is that we oppose history. We adamantly oppose history. We substitute myth for history. And myth is very, very dangerous, even when gripped by the oppressed. It's very, very dangerous that history is a liberating force. And that's why I have become so passionate about it. It's like when you look at these different examples, and particularly the thing I was mentioning before about the racial cleansing of industries, I mean, it really does change the discussion about what we need to be doing right now, who is benefiting from what, right? And with the AFL, they unfortunately reinforce this craft-only mentality. Now, by the early 20th century, that is, right after World War, around the time of World War I in the 1920s, their philosophy of organizing ran into significant problems because the nature of the economy was changing so dramatically. You had mass production industries where the distinction between skilled and unskilled became a little bit more complicated to identify. And it was in that situation when you had the rise of auto industry, the steel industry, shipbuilding, et cetera, that a different form of organization becomes necessary. And that's what Peter Agard and I decided to write about in our booklet, pictorial book, The Indispensable Ally, the formation of the CIO, because what happens is that by 1934 and then ultimately 1935, a major portion of the American Federation of Labor realizes that it cannot organize workers using the old methods of the AFL. And it's at that point that you see the rise of what comes to be known as industrial unionism, that is, organizing workers in industries rather than in crafts, which makes it much more difficult to segregate.
Absolutely.
Well, black folks aren't stupid. And we saw this and realized immediately that there were tremendous opportunities for us to improve our situation to the extent that we embrace this industrial unionism and played a role. And we and Chicanos and Asians played a very major role, which, again, up until maybe four decades ago, was largely ignored.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me as we're talking and learning from you about the true history of labor unions and labor organizations, certainly in this country, is how much, particularly for people of color, for African Americans, how much self-respect and self-esteem can come from the awareness of this history that you're reporting that, as you have said, has been largely hidden, rewritten, you name it. History is a critical piece of your self-esteem and your self-awareness, I would suggest.
It is, absolutely. And that was something when I was becoming politically active as a teenager many moons ago. And it was, you know, during the 60s and 70s, what I remember so well is with the spread of a renewed interest in African and African American history, that the attitude of people started to change about themselves. I mean, there were some of my friends in high school that had been, you know, nothing more than just players. And then they start reading things, the autobiography of Malcolm X, they start reading about Africa, et cetera, and all of a sudden they change in terms of the way they're operating, the way that they see themselves. And it is absolutely the case that in the absence of history, we really are lost. Or when we buy into the myths that pass for history in the United States, we're completely lost. And that is true in the labor movement. When we think, and I've had this discussion with many black folks who will say, well, you know, unions never did anything for us. Well, that's actually not true. And then you go even further when people think that unions have always been white institutions and it has nothing really to do with us. Well, again, that's not true. Had it not been for us in the 1930s, when the Congress of Industrial Organizations is moving forward, it is more than likely that the Congress of Industrial Organizations would have failed. And one of the classic examples of that was the organizing of the Ford Motor Company. Now, Ford, which in many ways reminds one of today's Walmart, was led by, of course, Henry Ford. Henry Ford was a visionary. He was also a fascist, and he was an anti-Semite. But he was a brilliant corporate leader. And what he understood, he introduced the assembly line. He also understood that he needed to raise the wages of his workers enough so that they could actually buy things. He didn't create a heaven on earth for them by any stretch of the imagination, but he realized that they couldn't be completely destitute, otherwise capitalism itself would completely collapse. So he introduced that, but he also very much understood divide and conquer. So he hired black workers. He kept them segregated, but he also did certain symbolic things, such as he provided laboratory space for the great scientist George Washington Carver, great African-American scientist. He developed a relationship, a corrupt relationship with black ministers in Detroit, so that many black ministers in Detroit, became the conduits for jobs at Ford. In other words, if you wanted a job at Ford, you had to go through this minister. And that minister would say yes and no in terms of whether you could essentially get a job. It was incredibly corrupt.
Indeed.
And when the CIO through the United Auto Workers was trying to organize, they were successful at Chrysler and at GM. They couldn't crack Ford. They couldn't break into Ford. And it was only after the NAACP and a group called the National Negro Congress, two African-American organizations, joined forces with the United Auto Workers that they were able to succeed in 1941 in organizing the workers there. Well, a lot of our folks don't realize that. And they think that this was all something done by some white folks somewhere. But we were central. And you can keep going through example after example of African-Americans, of Chicanos, of Asians that helped to build the labor movement. And up until the 1970s, we received precious little credit, you know, or acknowledgement of our role.
Bill, we're going to take a break, and in part, I think, to digest what you've shared with us. But when we come back, I'd like to really fast forward to the world of labor unions in today's environment and what you see happening and where you would like to see things go. So, folks, we are going to take a break. My name is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, mindtalk.org, and Bill Fletcher, who is giving us extraordinary amounts of important history about the labor union, about what's true versus what we often are told is true. We'll be right back. talking about your thoughts about what's going on today and your vision for the future, I just want to let the audience know even more about your history, because it will put what you have to say, I think, in an important context. In addition to being co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal, you served as president of Trans-Africa Forum, and you were formerly the education director and later assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. Clearly, you know from whence you speak. And there are so many other important things that you've done. But I really wanted to underscore that as I ask you again, what's happening in the labor union as far as you're concerned today? What is the impact of racism within the union? Is it all done? Does it still exist? And where do we go from here?
So I think that the first point is that if you exist in the United States of America, there's no institution where racism has evaporated. And so it's important to use that as the context, that no matter what the rhetoric may be, that it exists. It is a disease that has infected the system. And so in organized labor, you've had struggles for years around issues of racism and sexism. And some have been more successful than others, some of those struggles. We have had certain important changes in terms of who's on the executive council, the AFL-CIO. You've had the rise of important black figures in the union movement, the late John Sturtevant, for example, an African-American who was president of the American Federation of Government Employees, William Lucy, of course, who was longtime secretary-treasurer of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and the founding president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. So you have these very significant figures, A. Philip Randolph in the 20th century. The struggle continues. One of the greatest difficulties, though, within this thing called organized labor is that we're also infected by this hatred of history, this opposition, I should say, to history. So that exists within the United States as a whole, this opposition to really coming to grips with what happened. And so what one of the ways that this plays itself out in organized labor is that many unions don't want to talk about race because they fear that discussions about race will be divisive and that we should simply look forward. Well, that doesn't work. I mean, first, we are divided. I mean, it's obvious. If you look at the presidential campaigns of this year and you listen to the Trumps and the Cruises, it is clear that we're divided. The question is, how do you address that division? And so there have not been enough efforts taken at addressing race, except, you know, currently the AFL-CIO is embarked in an interesting project, a race commission that is trying to look at issues of race, and I applaud that. But many of the discussions about race take place in the absence of history. It becomes more of a focus on how do we better get along? You know, how do we better understand each other? How do we make sure to avoid using certain words? And while all of that may have a role, it's not central. What's central is to really understand how race operates, why it was created in the first place, as a mechanism of oppression, as a mechanism of social control. If you don't have those kind of discussions, then the discussions about how do we get along become superfluous. That's the challenge that we face today in terms of race. And that exists within the larger challenge of can we sustain and renew a labor movement? You know, I was reading something about this increase in the number of white women that are dying around the country, dying in their 40s, 50s, and 60s at a point when they shouldn't be. And people are trying to figure out what's going on. Well, part of what's going on is that the economy has been crushing a lot of working people. Well, it's crushed us for a long time,
right.
We as people of color. But white folks, see, it wasn't supposed to work this way for white folks. At least that's what they thought. They thought that, well, it might happen to other people, but it won't happen to us. But now it's happening to them, and they don't know how to deal with it. And that's when you really need organization that is fighting, that is challenging the way that the system is operating, challenging the gross economic inequalities, the gross polarization of wealth. But you also need it as a movement that tackles and does not avoid racial and gender inequalities. And that, I would argue, is the question that sits before the movement. Is the movement up to that, or would it rather exist in some sort of magical environment?
I think you have a guesstimate answer to that based on your reality today.
I think that if it doesn't, we're toast.
Toast.
We're toast. And, you know, any... There's no democracy or nothing approaching democracy if workers do not have organization, if workers are not in a position to improve and bargain for their living conditions, if there's not an organization that's looking out for health care and housing and looking to improve the status of the majority of the population. There is no democracy. What you end up having is described well by the term that's become more popular, a plutocracy. You have a political and economic system that exists solely for the rich. And such a system is highly unstable and ultimately can only sustain itself through increased violence. Increase repression, and that's not the future that I want for my daughter, for my friends and family. That's not the kind of future, and so we need a movement. But that movement has to have the courage to face the challenge of its own history, and I realize that that's actually quite scary.
For many, yes.
Yeah, it is. It is. You know, there was a HBO series, Band of Brothers, that was about the 101st Airborne Division during World War II, and it's an incredible series, a multi-part series for anyone that hasn't seen it. And I often use this story to make a point. In the second or third segment, there are replacements coming up to the front, and this is after the D-Day, after the invasion of Normandy, and they run into someone who had been there at the invasion of Normandy, and who was a veteran, and the veteran says to these replacements, he says, "You're scared, aren't you?" And they say, "Yeah," and he says, "That's because you don't realize you're already dead," and they look at him in horror, and he says, "As long as you think you're alive, you're not going to be able to fight the Germans. Once you realize that you're dead, then you have a chance." And I thought about that, and I said, wow, this is, like, pretty heavy. But, at first glance, it sounds like he's suggesting that people do something suicidal, but that's not what he was saying. What he was saying was something far more important for all of our movement. When your principal objective is protecting yourself, you cannot take on an opponent. Because you're trying, it's simply self-preservation. It's at the point when you say, my future rests in taking down this opponent. That's when you have the chance to win. And that's what every great social movement has understood. That is precisely what our movement, the Black Freedom Movement, understood. And it's what organized labor understood at its most important and strongest points. That it can't be positioning. None of these movements can position themselves constantly on the defensive. They have to be ready to take risks because there is, at the end of the day, very little for us to lose.
So it can't be about me. It has to be about us in order for us to survive.
That's right. It has to be. I don't see any alternative. It has to be about us. And that means, in the case of organized labor, a different kind of labor movement. And that's what my co-author, Fernando Gapacin, and I tried to get across in our book, Solidarity Divided, that we need a different kind of labor movement. It's not about the abandoning of the existing unions. It means going beyond that. It means building up a movement that has a more compelling vision, a vision, and is prepared to talk about things like race and gender, but also to talk about the kind of healthcare system that we need, the kind of economic development programs that we need, the kind of cities that we need. It needs to be willing and able to talk about the environment and environmental devastation. What good are jobs if we can't breathe?
Right.
What good are jobs if we can't drink any water? Or, in fact, if there's no water to drink? Right. So a different kind of vision of a union movement is what is desperately needed at this moment. And there are elements out there that I think lead me to be optimistic.
Such as?
The Fight for 15 movement, the fight around raising the minimum wage, the efforts underway at Walmart to organize workers. There's an organization called Our Walmart, which is Walmart workers that are attempting to organize for justice. And they are doing it outside of a traditional union framework. The National Domestic Workers Alliance, which has been developing over the last 10 years, beginning first largely as an organization in New York. The New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which is organizing workers that legally don't have the right to unionize. But they've built an organization that essentially resembles a union, and with a workforce that everyone said could not be organized.
Legally, they're not able to...
That's right, because they are contractors. You see, what happened... There was a very slick move that was made in the 1980s, and it affected vast parts of the economy, but there was a particular impact on the taxi industry, and that was when you had the rise of subcontracting. What you did is that you removed people from the status of being an employee and instead put them in a category as a contractor. So in simple terms, at the end of the year, instead of getting a W-2, you get a 1099. That basically, so nothing is taken out of your salary, and no taxes. The obligation comes to you to pay everything, and this presented a great opportunity for employers because they no longer had the legal obligations to deal with an employee. They could basically just contract with someone or terminate their contract at a whim. And so in the taxi industry, what happened was that once upon a time you had taxi workers, drivers, that worked for companies. And they were employees of a particular company. But then the taxi industry shifted so that these taxi drivers became contractors, where they either had to own or rent their own cabs. So Uber is simply the logical extension of that. And it both floods the market with taxi drivers, but it further degrades their basic conditions.
So it gives us an interesting way, a new way to look even at Uber and Lyft and all of these services that are popping up, sometimes seemingly out of nowhere.
Oh, exactly. And you know, when you I remember when once upon a time, you go into a gas station and people would come out, And they would pump your gas. They would check your oil. They would clean your windows.
Long ago and far away.
That's right. That's right. And then you pay and drive off. And then you started to see fewer of these stations, and more you were responsible for doing this. And that ethos has permeated the entire economy. So you have fewer bank tellers, you have ATMs, and all of this is done when with the flag of convenience being flown, that this is more convenient for you, the customer. Actually, what it is, it's not about convenience. It's about reducing costs on the part of the employer and or the owner, and putting the burden on you. So Uber ends up just extending that. It's that now, you know, anybody basically can be a taxi driver. There's no training. Almost all the responsibilities end up falling on you as the Uber driver. And if something happens to you, well, you know, as the bumper sticker says, things happen.
Bill Fletcher, you have given us so much to think about. I very much appreciate your time. I have a suspicion I'm going to be asking you to come back and talk to us some more. You know, as you've said, as we've said, an awareness of the truth of one's history, in addition to raising one's self-esteem, self-awareness, self-respect, it gives you so many more options moving forward in terms of how you're going to respond, what you're going to look for, what you're going to accept. So thank you for giving us this very important piece of learning, and I suspect new learning for most, maybe a reminder for some. Bill Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Bill, is there a way for people to follow your work?
Yes, and again, thank you very much for having me on the program. I have a website, which is billfletcherjr.com. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook, and I respond to communications. So for your listeners, if you have further questions, please feel free to reach out to me. And on this labor history, just as a final note, ever since the 1970s with the work of Philip S. Foner, there's been an increase in attention to the real history of organized labor. And I would encourage your listeners to just take a look. It's fascinating.
It certainly is. Thank you again, Bill, very much.
Thank you.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to Pamela@mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, please, if it is unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.